With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going. You're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Fight. It's time for the Publisher Fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new Ingram power.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to episode 11 of the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week. And this week's guest is Lindsay Clay. Lindsay is CEO of Thinkbox. If you're not familiar with Thinkbox, they are a marketing body representing the cream of UK TV broadcasters who co-fund this organization to go out there and do various different things. They're highly effective, and if you want to test that effectiveness, I suggest you go on Twitter, make some erroneous claim about how digital advertising is superior to TV advertising in some way, and it will not be long before you find yourself surrounded by Thinkbox staff who will provide graphs, data points, research, all demonstrating TV's effectiveness. Just one final reminder for anyone who wants to be involved in the Video and OTT Advertising Guide for 2021. The deadline is fast approaching, and if your company would like to take part, please get in touch. Now, through the power of editing, we will cross over to my conversation with Lindsay, and I hope you really enjoy it. Welcome to the podcast, Lindsay.
Thank you very much.
Today's a big day for Thinkbox. I know that your chair, Tess Alps, has stepped down, and she's played a really integral role in what Thinkbox have been doing over the last couple of years. So could you just start out by giving us a bit of an overview of what Thinkbox do and the role that Tess has played? Because I think she's a much loved person in the industry.
Okay, lovely. So Thinkbox is the official marketing body for commercial TV. So we are funded by the commercial TV companies to help everybody get the best out of TV as a medium. So we commission lots of research, looking at the effectiveness of TV. We look at the impact of new technology and how it's going to change consumer behavior. And we have a whole program of events and PR and, you know, award schemes, etc. So Tess has been our non-exec chair for many years now, but she was also the first real CEO of Thinkbox. She's the one that made it what it is today. And so it's an enormously sad day for us that she's finally decided to retire. We've basically been emotionally blackmailing her for years to try and persuade her to stay on in some shape or form. And we've benefited enormously from her help, advice, inspiration, support. But she's finally decided that she needs to spend more time with her vegetables, and enough's enough. So she's very sadly retiring formally in December.
And what were you doing before you joined Thinkbox? What have you done in your career before you became CEO?
Well, most of my career I have spent working for the creative side of advertising, so creative advertising agencies. So I worked for a whole series of ad agencies in London, doing lots and lots of TV advertising. So it was very good training for my career at Thinkbox. And my most recent agency was JWT, J. Walter Thompson, as it was then. I spent 10 years there, so sort of, you know, woman and girl almost. It was just the impending 10-year anniversary of me being there that triggered me suddenly thinking, oh, actually, I think I might like to do something else now.
So let's just move on to the TV industry. I mean, I think I've mentioned on past episodes, but I think the TV industry has had a particularly frustrating pandemic. They've seen huge audiences exactly at the time that advertisers started pausing campaigns and pulling spend. How would you describe the mood in the TV industry at the moment?
I would probably describe it as optimistic. I think there is really positive green shoots coming up all the time. So if you look at the sort of pattern of what happened during the pandemic, yeah, it was really odd, wasn't it? Because we had these extraordinary viewing figures, you know, viewers completely reassessing TV, reevaluating it, I suppose spiked by news in particular, people were really catching up with news, but, spending much more time at home. And so not surprisingly, you know, discovering content, you know, recommending content to each other, comfort and nostalgia and in all sorts of ways. And yet advertisers, for all sorts of reasons, were pulling spend like mad. So I think in the early stages, what our shareholders did was to try and be as supportive as they could to advertisers, because it was a really, really difficult time for them. Many categories were just so challenged. You know, travel, for instance, was just completely decimated. So they were as flexible as they could possibly be about facilitating them to cancel campaigns or defer campaigns. And I think that is really paying off now, because the money is most definitely coming back. And if you look at the last few months, you know, April was down very significantly. Like most of the industry, it was down by about 50%, I think. But as every month has gone past, that has reduced a bit. And so, you know, I think there's real optimism heading into the autumn. I mean, it's measured, of course, because everyone's looking at the economic situation and thinking, you know, I think we've got challenging times ahead, but there's absolutely no reason why TV shouldn't, get more than its fair share of the advertising money available.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've been covering quite a bit is just the different ways that people are adapting. I feel like so far this feels like a big TV love in. I'm trying not to get on that path, particularly with the TV marketing body.
Yes, it's not a good look.
But in all honesty, you know, we have spent years, you know, looking at the TV industry and sort of being quite frustrated that maybe they weren't moving fast enough in some ways. Now you can argue whether it was right or wrong, whether they were should have been into data-driven advertising earlier or whatever else. But we really have been seeing, you know, in the last few months alone, probably more initiatives coming from the TV industry than any other sector in terms of being more flexible with advertisers, providing additional incentives for, smaller advertisers to sort of get involved as part of the mix. The thing of the venture initiatives, taking equity in companies in exchange for giving small startups TV advertising. All of those initiatives, I think, have just been like just brilliant to see. Mm. And it has felt like a really rapid response for, you know, an industry that is sometimes perceived as being, you know, slow moving or, and I think it's been, you know, the opposite almost, that they've been the fastest to respond this time around. So yeah, it is encouraging, and I think credit where credit's due.
Oh.
So I don't know if you have anything to add to that, but
I think it's interesting, this whole thing about could the industry have moved faster into this, the whole world of data and technology. I think if you think about it, the TV industry has completely transformed itself as far as the viewer is concerned. And I suppose what I would say is they have prioritized the needs of the viewer in order to then facilitate a positive environment for advertising. So if you think about how viewing has changed, you know, since when was it, about 2007, that, you know, on-demand digital television recorders properly came in and on-demand started to, you know, appear with the launch of the BBC iPlayer. And since that time now, viewers have completely embraced the idea of, you know, viewing flexibly, you know, viewing whenever they want, whatever they want. And the broadcasters have really led the charge on that. You know, they have invested in technology. They have, you know, very conscious that they need to, you know, retain viewing in all its forms and give viewers what they want. And I think that is one of the special things about the TV industry, which is it's a sort of delicate equilibrium that only works. It's a sort of three-way thing that has to work for every one of the different parties involved. So it's got to work for the viewers. It's got to work for the TV companies and the producers, but it's also got to work for the advertisers. And I think because of that, it's very balanced. I think that means that, they don't ride roughshod over the experience of viewers. in the quest to make ever more advertising money. And I think some other media are certainly guilty of that. If you look at some of the excesses in some parts of online advertising, it's an appalling experience as a user. They're completely trying to max out the, you know, advertising revenue as much as they possibly can. And TV is certainly not guilty of that. Yes, I suppose they could have moved more quickly into, you know, advertising solutions, but it's absolutely happening now. There's serious investments going on. And I think in a way, the delay has helped because the TV industry is largely, you know, dependent on high quality first party data willingly volunteered by viewers, because they appreciate that, you know, if they give their data, what they get is, you know, high quality TV services and some advertising on the side. So I think the TV industry, in a way, you know, perhaps the delay will help it, because, you know, we're moving into a much more secure and safe future.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good point, actually. I think the idea that the TV industry maybe has almost second mover advantage in that they're coming into this just as consumers are finally starting to become actually concerned about privacy. I mean, do you think the TV industry is going to benefit from privacy regulation that we're starting to see? And, you know, things, and then, you know, there's other developments online with the, you know, the cookie and what's happening with the browsers.
I would hope so, because I think they're less exposed than other media to some of the excesses around that. You know, if you you know, moving into a cookie-free future is less of a problem for TV than for a lot of media. So yes, I would hope that you know, the increased focus on privacy and, you know, the information, you know, the work that the Information Commissioner's Office is doing will only help TV, because of course it's always been a hugely trusted environment. You know, everybody knows that TV advertising you know, can be trusted and is not going to completely bombard you. You know, you know what you're getting with TV advertising. The same is not the true of other media. So I think TV has got lots to feel good about.
We had Johnny Ryan on last week, and he wasn't particularly complimentary about the Johnny Ryan's, I don't know if you're familiar with Johnny, he's chief policy officer for Brave, their privacy focused browser. Mm-hmm. But he was particularly critical of the ICO and the lack of teeth and the lack of resources given to the teams of tackle, you know, that are being entrusted.
Got a big challenge on their hands, haven't they? But they have issued lots of warnings. You know, they've certainly made their intent very clear. But let's hope that they've got some power to do something about it as well.
So, one of the things, I think one of the sort of recurring things, it's particularly entertaining for the neutral on Twitter, is, you know, the Thinkbox. You frequently lock horns with various players on the digital side. I know TV people get annoyed when you say digital. So the online web natives say.
Yeah.
And whether it's, you know, it could be around research they've put out, audience data, or I think one of the famous ones, and I know this irks Google staff to this day, was the one day they had Eileen Naughton saying, you know, YouTube was going to basically destroy TV.
Yes, and take 4% out of your TV budget and put it in YouTube, I think it was at the time.
Yeah. And then the following day, Matt Britton was at IBC sort of saying, you know, we want to be friends with the TV industry. And I think, you know, it also explains why Google comms is so strict in terms of letting anyone say anything, because these, if you have two people speaking off different scripts, it can go horribly wrong. But what do you make of your relationship with, I know it's a broad question, but with that online tech world?
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? So I think, if I'm being honest, they are potentially brilliant partners to TV as a medium, because they offer largely complementary media for advertisers. So in a perfect world, you know, it would be an ideal combination, you know, having combination of TV and some form of, you know, social media, online video options and search. You know, that could be a perfect package. But unfortunately, and they're not all the same either, but some of them have, you know, well and truly lived down to our expectations. And I think probably Facebook is particularly guilty of this. You know, they've been untrustworthy, they've been unsafe, they've shirked their responsibilities, they consistently, you know, deny the fact that they are a media owner and therefore, you know, shirk their responsibilities there. And, you know, they've proved themselves untrustworthy time and time again. You know, they've made measurement mistakes. They've provided unsafe environments for advertising. There's a lack of transparency. There's a lack of responsibility. And I don't think they fund the industry institutions to the degree that, you know, they should. And I think it's slightly coming home to roost now, because, you know, it doesn't really matter what we think of them and what our attitude is. But, you know, most importantly, advertisers are extremely critical of them at the moment. And that takes a lot, doesn't it? It takes a lot for advertisers to, you know, vote with their money. And, you know, there is a group of advertisers who are certainly being very critical of Facebook at the moment. So I hope it will persuade them to, you know, think differently and take their responsibilities seriously. I think Google is a different kettle of fish. They are a tech partner to many companies. They've got so many different strings to their bow. I suppose the area where they particularly compete with TV is on YouTube. And, you know, YouTube is a great way of reaching young people and very complementary to TV. I think there's a lot of the same criticism about, you know, marking your own homework, different measures at stake. So, you know, the online industry, when they talk about a video view, largely they mean, you know, 50% of the pixels for 2 seconds as a minimum, whereas TV, it's an average view, which is 30 seconds. You know, there's all sorts of areas where we would take issue, but I think it's different kettle of fish.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think it is. It's very difficult to compare them as, you know, apples for apples, and I think inevitably when there's such different language and the same issues crop up with, you know, with everything from, I mean, measurement, as you said, is one of the main ones, but also, you know, terminology. I know Nigel Wally would be delighted that we've mentioned terminology. Yeah, I've got to duck because, yeah, it is, I think terminology is it's an ongoing industry problem. That it's something that we struggle with, and I think everyone I speak to, even if you're going from market to market, you just find that different people use different terms for different things. Mm-hmm. So what's the greatest challenge for Thinkbox as an organization then?
Ooh, that's there's always interesting challenges for us. I think probably the biggest is to get people to rethink and reassess TV. I get very frustrated when TV is boxed in as people refer to traditional TV. And, you know, the last thing TV is traditional. You know, it is, you know, it's 100% digital. It's, you know, it is investing, you know, massively in data and tech solutions. It's completely powered by the internet. Probably at some stage in the future will be, you know, it will move over to being 100% IP delivered rather than, you know, delivered by broadcast technology. And so, you know, it's changing and transforming all the time. And yet people very often define it by the performance of linear TV. And, you know, a good example of this is if you ever see an article about TV, it will very often, for some inexplicable reason, be illustrated by 1950s TV sets. So I don't know if you've ever noticed this. You won't have, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I've seen it. I think we've probably used them in the past. But
I don't know why that is the default image. And it's so wildly out of date.
I think it's the black screens look so boring. the black screens, if you have the black flat screen on an image, it just looks terrible. It looks boring. Well,
the 1950s boxes, they just look sad. They're completely unrepresentative. So that is a frustration, but I think that sort of indicates something about the mindset. So what I'd like to do is get people to wake up to, you know, TV is this sort of, you know, medium in revolutionary change. It's completely transforming. It's become the sort of Swiss Army knife of media because it's got so many different new tools in the TV toolbox. Yes, it's fantastic for brand building, but it's also brilliant at, you know, really focused targeting, at, you know, data matching, at, you know, all sorts of different techniques it's got now. So I'd love people to reassess it.
Yeah, out of the new, you know, when it comes to the new tools, are there any that particularly jump out at you as, you know, I think data-driven advertising or addressability, I think that's, it sort of speaks for itself. Particularly on the creative side, there's things like shoppable video that we see pop up, and these things seem to pop up for a while, and you're never entirely sure whether it's just a shiny new object to talk to, you know, to lure in some advertisers, you know, before they do the big spend, which is turns out to be a mass reach campaign that, you know. Or, you know, are you seeing anything that looks particularly compelling? But, you know, with on the creative part is what I'm really interested in.
So the creative part, I think probably some of the contextual tools that are now available. So context is so important in advertising, you know, having that perfect blend of advertising, you know, within a very appropriate environment. And people have always been able to, you know, target the right context. Because, you know, they can do it just by, you know, picking the right programs. But there are now ways of, you know, Channel 4's got a great example. I think their contextual moments tool. They can look for, I don't know, if you've got a particular brand and you want it to be associated with birthdays. They've got an AI tool that can go through all the programs looking for, you know, scenes of, you know, somebody having a birthday, and then so that the advertising can be placed as near as possible to that. So it's actual moments as well as the whole programming environment. So I think, you know, increasingly sophisticated versions of that is great. I think the whole, from a creativity point of view, I think the whole way that sponsorships and content partnerships are developing is really interesting. You know, because in the old days, you'd maybe pay to sponsor a program and you'd probably do, you know, a few brake bumpers, and you'd probably do not enough of them so that they would be endlessly repetitive and a bit boring. And now there are so many possibilities. So, you know, you do some, you know, fantastically creative sponsorship bumpers. You can have product placement in the programming, but, you know, that is a completely seamless part of the programming. It doesn't, you know, stand out and make its you know, presence annoying. You can license elements of the program to use in your advertising. You can, you know, come up with, you know, talent and partnership deals. And I think there are, you know, some brilliant examples of that.
Yeah, I think even the bumpers to a show, and my girlfriend's desired car tends to switch with whatever is sponsoring Channel 4 drama.
Yeah, at any exactly.
Given time, it's literally, oh, I want one of those. Okay, so one of the things that has been a sort of recurring theme for the TV industry is, you know, to what extent they should consolidate, whether that's, I think there's various consolidation when it comes to TV industry. It's not just an M&A thing of joining up companies and, you know, firing marketing departments to make organizations more efficient, but I think there's a few different ways they can consolidate, whether it's through, you know, joint sales efforts, which is something they've been doing for quite some time, or combined apps to, you know, strengthen the content offering in a unified experience. Do you think there's the TV industry would benefit from deepening consolidation and merging together, or, you know, do you feel like that, you know, they're doing a good enough job today as it is with their current efforts?
Well, it's a really interesting point. And I think one of the characteristics of the TV industry, which differentiates it from some others, is that the biggest brands all around the world in TV are largely local ones. So if you know, whichever country you go to, generally the biggest and most significant player will be a local one. And the same is true in the UK. And that's because people love local content. You know, that's absolutely their favorite content. It's stuff in their own language. It's stuff that is, you know, made, that relates, that shows people like them, that, you know, tells stories that they can relate to. It's not that they don't like other content too, but you know what they really love is the local stuff. So it's not surprising that the biggest brands are local ones. However, the competitors of TV are enormous global companies. So there's definitely a bit of a disconnect there, and it makes it something of a challenge for TV. So I think there possibly is room for consolidation, but if that consolidation is going to be result in success, the local strength of the local operators has got to be prioritized, and it will always be vital. So whether it's consolidation or collaboration, maybe I think there's definitely scope for more collaboration. And I think Carolyn McCall, who's the chief executive of ITV, talked about an opportunity for the TV companies to compete on content but collaborate on technology. And I think within the bounds of TV is a market and they're all competitive companies, and you have to be very careful about collaboration on commercial issues. I think there are all sorts of opportunities to collaborate on technology, on sharing platforms, technology platforms, sharing measurement solutions, a whole wealth of possibilities there.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's certainly a strand of thought that, I think, an example would be Mediaset, who I think they've been trying to take a stake in ProSieben, and I think it might still be, I think the regulators for competition might still be taking a look at it. Mm-hmm. Do you think joint ownership structures would benefit the industry, or?
Well, it can help. There can be benefits, and it can help to give scale, to the production offering, to the advertising offering. That's really what it can offer, and I suppose shared best practice and a bit more muscle. One of the things that is makes it challenging from the way that TV is structured is that if you think about the way most global companies are structured, they would tend to have a sort of a global head of marketing. And so it's hard for the TV industry to talk to that person because, it's so fragmented across markets. So if you could have a bit more consolidation, then it would help in that conversation. Of course, TV's competitors, the tech platforms, are beautifully geared up. Their structure reflects the structure of, global advertising companies. So they do very well there.
Yeah, I think, it seems to be up for debate. I've spoken to agency people who, when EBX was launched, for example, for anyone who doesn't know, that's the European Broadcaster Exchange, and it was a number of the leading European broadcasters from Channel 4, TF1, ProSieben, and Mediaset, and I'm feeling one or two have joined since, that I'm forgetting. But anyway, the agencies were scratching their heads a little bit, saying, we don't really do business that way.
Yes.
We don't really run that many pan-European campaigns, but I think there's... I think there seems to be some people who do, or certainly they want to strike deals and then have them executed locally. Mm-hmm. It seems to be slightly unclear. Just on the app side of things, the Project Kangaroo was the ill-fated attempt by various European broadcasters. I forget the year. I think it was 2011. Something like that. But anyway, it was an attempt to create a sort of unified online environment / app. Pretty sure that was the sort of core focus, but it got struck down by the regulators before they were able to do it. I mean, do you think something like that? I mean, for me, that would be extremely compelling if I was to be able to go in and see ITV, Channel 4, all BBC content all in one place. I think it would be my first go to app. Do you think they benefit from having that kind of a unified app experience?
It's extremely frustrating, isn't it? Because, because of some, unvisionary decision that was made several years ago, it set the industry, the TV industry, off down a particular path. And it's very hard to row back from that now because, of course, there's been so much investment in individual players Actually, the viewer is extremely well served, aren't they? Because they've got, everybody's made an investment in their individual offerings. So it's, it'd be ironic if now that you suddenly said, okay, it's fine. Actually, it was all a big mistake. Yes, of course, you can consolidate. There's an awful lot of money been wasted since. So I think there are ways. Yes, I suppose if you were starting again, then yes, it would be great to have everything together. But there are ways. It's actually not that hard, is it? And I think with connected TV and depending on what kind of platform you've got, it's relatively easy to navigate between the various options. So I don't think it doesn't appear to be a barrier to viewing at the moment. Yes, it would be better and more seamless, but actually, largely, things are presented together, in app form on the TV screen. So, viewers seem to be able to find them reasonably easily.
Now, I know you're not a BritBox spokesperson, but is there any chance that BritBox, I think BritBox was something that I was quite, ooh, that's quite excited to see what they do with this. And then it seems to be a repository for older content mostly. Do you think that there's any chance we'll see a more ambitious version of BritBox, or that BritBox could be the first step in?
Well, it's interesting. I think the whole future of the streaming wars, as they call them, are is fascinating, isn't it? And just to see how many different competitive offerings there are, people's insatiable demand for watching on demand, high quality on demand content. I mean, that's been a real vote of confidence in TV, if you think about it. This is a really healthy, positive part of the TV ecosystem that viewers have embraced with a passion. Projecting forward, it's likely that, there's going to have to be some, consolidation, I suppose, because you can't. I think viewers at some point are going to say, "Well, we're not going to sign up and pay for 10 different options." That'll probably be rationalised at some point. So yes, there could be an exciting future for an expanded BritBox. It's certainly a great offering, and from what I was saying earlier about local content, it works brilliantly from that point of view. And yes, you may say, oh well, it's largely old content, but as I often say, a repeat is only a repeat if you've seen it before. So there's a load of people who are discovering that brilliant content for the first time and loving it. So I don't know what the future holds, but it's certainly a very exciting, vibrant time.
So at the governmental level, we've seen sort of various committees put forward proposals for protecting domestic TV in the UK. They're sort of appreciating it, not just on a competition level, but also, on a cultural level of having an indigenous industry in terms of jobs and creativity. Do you think, we're going to see meaningful action and what do you think the action could look like?
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because I really hope so. I think that the pandemic has demonstrated in spades the value of a healthy TV industry and how important it is to viewers. So there's something really valuable here that it needs and deserves protecting. And so I would hope that there's a new spirit in government for valuing that and supporting it. But they do seem to have a terrible habit of reverting to, rather than focusing on, protecting and supporting TV, to handicapping it and, tying its hands even more. So, a great example is the regulation around TV. So TV is a highly regulated medium already, as is its advertising. And rather than, look at the tech giants and say, well, hang on a minute, the Wild West of online actually needs some curbs and checks and balances put in place. How can, government, intervene in a positive way there? They just seem to add more and more regulation to TV. So whether it's gambling or high fat, salt and sugar, There's always something in the spotlight. So rather, and it always seems that to be that TV shoulders an unfair burden relative to the other players. So I would really hope that they would value it, but you know, endlessly piling more and more regulation on TV rather than on, you know, the other media is not helping.
Yeah, it does feel like that might be slowly starting to change, but there is, yeah, I think there is an acceptance that the internet is this wild west of everything from, you know, in so many different ways, in so many different nefarious ways, that I think it almost overwhelms people. And I think the international
it's not a good enough excuse, is it? You know, big and difficult and complicated. So therefore, let's focus on what is straightforward and easy.
Yeah,
you have to grapple with these issues, and you know, there's definitely some work that needs done there.
Yeah. So if you could wave a magic wand and solve one problem for the TV industry today, what would it be?
I think it would probably be this leveling the playing field between, you know, TV and some of the online platforms, you know, in ways that we've just talked about. I think that would be, you know, one of the best things that could possibly happen for TV, in short.
So the regulation side of things...
Yeah,
the measurement.
Yes. I think, you know, advertisers are very accepting of total lack of transparency from some of the online media owners. You know, that they don't have, you know, third party organisation like Barb. They don't have a JIC. They just, you know, tell them how it's performed. Tell them how much it's going to cost. And it's all very opaque. So I think it would be good to have a more level playing field there. And then some of the, you know, regulation, you know, about how and where they're able to make money in advertising. You know, they shirk their responsibilities as online media owners and claim that, you know, they're not publishers. But, you know, they very happily take the money and they don't take enough responsibility for the advertising money that they're taking. So I think, you know, leveling up that and putting some checks and balances in place would be really valuable.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think's behind that? You know, I know the Facebook campaign is going on at the moment, but there has been this repeated acceptance by advertisers that, like Facebook have a story, you know, again, this is a cliche coming out of my mouth. I think I've said this a few times, but there seems to be a story about Facebook in the news literally every week, if not sometimes a few times a week, about various forms of, you know, I think sometimes it isn't always fair, and it's just somebody did something on their platform. There are certain cases where you can't really say that they were responsible. It was the individual, but in so many of them it clearly was bad behavior or bad leadership more often on Facebook's part. But why do you think, is it just that maybe, you know, to some extent advertisers have been, you know, almost hypnotized by the online world, that, you know, it can only be good, or you know, is it the fact that, you know, I think, you know, some advertisers will say that, you know, Facebook will deliver a fantastic return on their ad spend, and if there is some negative byproducts of that, well, I don't really care, provided nobody really makes a fuss.
To be fair to Facebook, it is a fantastically easy to use self-serve platform. So I think they have very cleverly geared it up around making it as easy as possible for people to book advertising onto that platform. And you can see how well they do, particularly with, you know, small and medium enterprises. You know, the bulk of their revenue, advertising revenue, comes from very small companies, because it's, you know, it's a great, it's an easy to use platform. You can start from the lowest spend possible. You can you know, scale it up. It's very easy, and I think that goes a long way. It's very easy if you know, we've looked into this to find out you know, why do media agencies, for instance, continue to invest so much in Facebook? And actually, it's for surprisingly practical reasons. It's not necessarily to do with effectiveness. They're not making decisions based on which is the most effective advertising solution. They're often making decisions based on, well, I've got half an hour before I leave tonight, and it's much easier to get that money away if I spend it on Facebook than on TV, for instance. So I think advertisers are not always being brilliantly served by some of these issues. But to, you know, give credit to Facebook, they've done an excellent job there. So you know, I think TV could learn from that in you know, simplifying and, you know, making it as easy as possible for people to spend money with us.
So one of the things you do outside of ThinkBox is you've been working with Wackel for many years now. So Wackel is an organization. I should have looked up the acronym. Women's Association for Communication.
It's Women in Advertising and Communications Leadership.
Yeah. And so do you feel that we're making progress on diversity in the industry, or is there more to be done? We can explain a bit about what Wackel is and how it works.
So Wackel is a club for senior women in the advertising and communications industry. And, you know, our purpose is to accelerate gender equality in the advertising industry. And we see that as being, yes, to the benefit of women, but it's also to the benefit of everyone. So, you know, we strongly believe that, you know, equality will benefit everybody. So, for example, we've got a major focus this year on flexible working, which is very timely, isn't it? Everybody's been working flexibly. But, you know, it's obvious that will benefit everyone. It will benefit parents and not just women. You know, to allow, you know, I think there's lots of men, for instance, who would want to spend more time with their kids and at home. But, you know, our working culture makes it very hard for them to make that decision because, you know, we judge them for not being serious about their careers if they want to prioritize, you know, time at home. So, you know, we're there to try and make some, you know, material change to try and get those stats going in the right direction. And, you know, there has been real progress. I think there's a proper engaged debate about it. All sorts of fantastic male allies in the industry, you know, who, you know, want to help make change. I think the senior leadership in agencies is slowly changing. It's not as representative as it should be. But I think the other thing that's interesting is, as we've learned, you can't just see diversity through one lens. And although, you know, we're very engaged in the gender debate, as you start to, you know, peel back the layers of that very quickly, you realize that, you know, you can't just look at gender alone. You've got to look at, you know, all the other protected characteristics. You've got to look at ethnicity and age and social background and disability and, you know, sexual orientation, all those different things, because, you know, it will benefit everybody. So I think I feel optimistic about the progress that's been made, but you know, there's a heck of a lot still left to do.
Yeah, I mean, what do you feel is left to do? I mean, I'm not for a second implying that there isn't much to do, but yeah. My feeling is that, you know, we've had an awful lot of conversations about this, and a lot of events. And I think things do come out of those events, and they can tilt, you know, shift attitudes and things. I would say that probably often the people who, you know, are attending or engaging with that type of content are. It's often people who are already interested in it.
Yeah, how many panels have you been to watch that on the topic of diversity, which have, you know, a lot of women, maybe a person of colour, and then a largely empty room because, you know, no one's interested in that. They've all walked out. So, yes, I think there is a lot to be done. I think we've got a pretty woeful record on ethnicity in particular, and, you know, the recent focus on, you know, with the hideous murder of George Floyd and the you know, focus on Black Lives Matter, I think that has been a very timely wake-up call for our industry, as well as you know, the ripple effect it's had all around the world, and I think we've got a long way to go on that, you know, with everything from better representation, you know, better career management, you know, removal of all those microaggressions, you know, unconscious bias. So I think, you know, I think that requires a lot of focus. And that is true in Wackle too. You know, we've been doing a lot of sort of self-scrutiny about, you know, have we supported the Black and minority ethnic women in the industry as well as we, excuse me, as well as we should have and could have. So, you know, we are trying to focus on that at the moment too.
Yeah, I think it's partly possibly that one of the things that the Black Lives Matter thing has done is giving people a bit more permission. I think there was, I spoke about this with Belinda J. Smith, who was on our podcast talking about Black Lives Matter. Mm. And I was saying that there's a huge amount of white awkwardness when it comes to talking about race that you're going. And I think sometimes even the diversity conversation, the more rules around different things that you can say, it feels like you're walking into the spider web of, if I say the wrong thing or if I phrase something that way, that can be interpreted as this. And then I do feel that sometimes maybe there needs to be a little bit more forgiveness, that is somebody who just is coming from a good place and, okay, I'm here, I am, I want to change, and that it's easy for them. I think occasionally we can sort of drift into territory where there's so many different rules, which are often moving very quickly, or if something has changed, or, you know, I can get my head around a trans person, you know, and where they're coming from, but maybe somebody of an older generation might find that really hard and might need a little bit more, we need to be kinder and a bit more patient.
Yeah,
I think in order for us all to,
definitely scope for kindness, isn't there, and finding ways to criticize and correct, but without that, you know, terrible, almost sort of, you know, public execution that seems to go on in social media when people get, when people stumble over terminology. So yes, I think a kinder, more constructive debate is more helpful, because otherwise we won't make any progress. You know, there's actually a fantastic program, I don't know if you've seen it, on, we caught up with it last night on Channel 4, called The School That Tried to End Racism. So I would encourage anybody to go and watch that, because yes, it's happened in a school, but all those issues that we're all dealing with are writ large amongst that group. It's incredibly inspiring and emotional viewing, but it helps to really explain the issues of both sides and, you know, how we can potentially get to a better place.
I've seen about half an hour of it, and it's incredible how quickly the kids get onto it, and they're quite open. And actually, I remember a kid saying exactly what I just said there about them being afraid to even talk about it, even though they clearly want to. Yeah,
it was being called a racist, so you know, that fueled their fear of saying the wrong thing. So therefore, they said nothing.
Yeah. Which was, I thought was fascinating. Okay, so my final question is to give you a 10 million of Monopoly money to invest in any one company. Who would you invest in and why? You're not allowed to invest in Thinkbox, of course.
No, well, I think I would be much even more self-serving than that. I would invest in the TV companies, of course. They're the ones who are with the bright future. That's where you're going to get your best returns. So that's definitely where I'd invest.
I should have reeled them out too. Okay, I'll give you that one. Lindsay, thanks so much for coming on. It's been a fantastic chat, and hope to have you again soon.
Thanks for having me.